This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iranian and Russian presidents assigned their foreign ministers to lay out a roadmap for long-term bilateral cooperation. North Korea warns the U.S. hostile policy is approaching a danger line and preparations must get underway for a long-term confrontation. Plus, the U.S. president threatening Russia with tough sanctions and severe costs of invading Ukraine. Thank you for joining us. Now, top stories, the presidents of Iran and Russia assigned their foreign ministers to work out a roadmap for mutual cooperation over the next two decades in their meeting in Moscow. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says he and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, will start work on the plan as of tomorrow. He says Ibrahim Raisi and Vladimir Putin discussed a spectrum of issues of mutual interest, with trade being at the heart of the conversation. Iran's economy minister also says Tehran and Moscow have reached an agreement on facilitating bilateral banking transactions. He says they've agreed to accelerate projects based on a $5 billion credit line, including three power generator stations and two rail and transit projects. Iran's president arrived in Moscow on Wednesday for a two-day visit.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iran and the three European signatories to the 2015 deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, have held talks in the Austrian capital. Our Vienna correspondent Hermeneski joined us earlier with an update. She said Iran has expressed its readiness to comply with the JCPOA commitments once the country is assured that sanctions will be removed in a verifiable manner.
But what we know from sources close to the talks is that at the moment there are still some sticking points, both when it comes to the issue of the list of sanctions that need to be removed by the Americans, and also on the issues of verification and guarantees, how the sanctions removal can be effectively verified for Iran, and how the U.S. can give guarantees to Iran that it will not withdraw from the deal again or reimpose sanctions once it is back in the JCPOA. And also there are still sticking points when it comes to the issue of implementation or sequencing. That would mean what actions, practical steps need to be taken by both Iran and the Americans to have the JCPOA restored. On the issue of sequencing, Iran has said time and again before, you might know, that it will only go back to its nuclear commitments after the effective removal of sanctions, after it has verified the removal of sanctions that need to be removed and are in violation of the JCPOA. We'll have to see if that can actually be achieved, but Iran has said that this is what it wants. What sources are saying is that at this stage, despite the fact that there are sticking points, besides, it is possible for them to overcome these differences. They're saying that these are not insurmountable issues, they can be overcome, and if there is the political will to do so, an agreement could be possible, as Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said, at a good pace.
Official data from China confirms the first imports of Iran's crude oil in a year, despite the ongoing U.S. sanctions. According to data from the Chinese Customs, the country brought in 260,000 tons of Iranian crude oil in December. It's not clear which company imported the latest cargo. Imports from Iran have accounted for about 6% of China's crude oil supply. The U.S. left a major international deal with Iran, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and reimposed the sanctions on the country in 2018. A year later, in April, the U.S. threatened to impose secondary sanctions on countries that continue to buy oil from Iran after an initial six-month waiver expired. North Korea is hinting that it may resume its nuclear and long-range missile tests to bolster its defense against the United States. North Korea's official news agency says leader Kim Jong-un has recently chaired a Politburo meeting of the ruling Workers' Party. The Politburo has given instructions to reconsider restarting all temporarily suspended activities. It appears to be a reference to the country's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, which is voluntarily halted in 2017. That was during Pyongyang's negotiations with Washington for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula that bore no results. Now, the North says the hostile US policy has reached a level that cannot be ignored anymore. The Politburo is urging more thorough preparation for what it calls a long-term confrontation with the US. The US President ups the ante against Russia in his inauguration anniversary presser, vowing to impose tough sanctions on Moscow if Ukraine is invaded.
And so I think what you're going to see is that Russia will be held accountable if it invades. And it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having to fight about what to do and not do, etc. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia if they further invade Ukraine, and that our allies and partners are ready to impose severe cost and significant harm on Russia and the Russian economy.
Biden says his guess is that Russian President Vladimir Putin will launch an incursion into Ukraine. However, he notes that Putin does not want a full-blown war. Biden warns that Russia will no longer be able to deal in dollars in case of an act of aggression. He adds that Washington could work out a plan whether to station, quote, strategic weapons in Ukraine. Biden says it was unlikely that Ukraine could join NATO in the near term, as it still needed to work on its democratic reforms. Political commentator Vladimir Goldstein says the Ukrainian crisis is primarily because the West disregards the fact that Russia is not interested in NATO expanding towards its border.
What has to be clear to your audience is that Russia is not interested in invading Ukraine. This is not in their strategic interest, not in their, in tactical interest. What they want to do is to sit with the West and ask them not to expand the NATO. And they keep on saying it in one terms, in another terms. And the West does want to face it. They do not want to face their absolutely aggressive and reckless politics, pushing NATO, spending too much money on armaments, on defense sector, channeling money away from regular projects to the military. So they need to come up with a story that Russia is aggressive. Russia is not interested in Ukraine. So just this is like totally red herring, and Biden knows it, and State Department knows it, and NATO knows it, but they keep on pushing it just because it helps and gullible public buy it. I find this very, very kind of silly and outrageous, but that's the way it is. This is not the first time, this is not the last time the West comes up with a red herring and starts chasing it.
Another partisan rift emerging in the U.S. Congress. Democrats failed to push ahead with two voting rights bills amid the widespread opposition from Republican senators. Democrat lawmakers have suffered a defeat after Senate Republicans blocked their bid for major reforms to voting rights. Their attempts to change the voting threshold from a two-thirds majority to a simple majority also failed after two Democrats joined the Republicans in opposing the measure. President Joe Biden immediately reacted to his party's defeat, saying he was profoundly disappointed but not deterred. The proposed reforms address a series of new voting restrictions across the U.S. The Democratic Party says conservative states use these restrictions against racial minorities, and changes are needed before the midterm elections later this year. The controversy over the so-called Partygate scandal in the UK is far from over. The British Prime Minister once again faces calls for resignation amid a revolt within his own party over new revelations about the 2020 Downing Street party.
Mr. Speaker, like so many people up and down the country, he has concluded that the Prime Minister and the Conservative Party have shown themselves incapable of offering the leadership and government this country deserves.
No matter the excuse, there is no excuse for taking the British people for fools. Will the Prime Minister agree it is now time for him to resign?
Boris Johnson is facing yet another grilling from the opposition in Parliament. He not only deflected again the resignations called, but said he is intensely proud of what his government has achieved. The latest round of pressure over Johnson's breach of COVID rules comes amid reports that lawmakers from his own party are turning their backs on him. The Daily Telegraph says so far 12 Tories have submitted letters of no confidence in him. So far, several leaked videos and emails have revealed about the parties held at Downing Street Garden and other government departments, but Johnson says nothing can be confirmed until a senior government official concludes an internal investigation. A number of British MPs have brushed aside claims that they are unfairly targeting Bahrain, as observers say the kingdom has a well-documented and abysmal human rights record, and Bahrain is trying to silence British parliamentarians and peers calling it out. Bayanka Rahimi tells us more from London.
Bahrain has a tiny population of 1.7 million, but boasts the highest prison population per capita. Thousands of those are political prisoners. Every family has members who have done time, and the stories of torture and abuse are harrowing. Human rights organizations and defenders have been documenting them for years.
There is multiple evidence of torture against both men and women who have been politically outspoken. And there are people who have been languishing in prison for 10 years now. Children who have had their teeth knocked out, they have been raped, they have had their genitals connected to electrical shock devices, car batteries or whatever, and have been driven around the villages, told that they would have their mothers or their sisters raped and violated if they did not snitch on their friends or the fellow villagers who would have been involved in the nightly protests against the continued abuse of fellow prisoners.
But this man, Omar Al-Hassan, the chairman of the Persian Gulf Centre for Strategic Studies, has accused UK MPs and peers of making biased and fabricated criticisms of Bahrain. The kingdom's rulers are squirming in the wake of more and more criticism coming from Britain.
My lords, earlier this year I raised with the noble lord, Lord Ahmed, the detention of children in Bahrain following reports of their physical abuse and forced confessions.
My lords, a year ago this week, the Bahrain's courts upheld the death penalty for Mohammed Ramadan and Hussein Musa, following commitments made to do so in the other place by the Minister for the Middle East and North Africa. What representations has Her Majesty's government made to the government of Bahrain on the death penalty?
The GCSS says Bahrain's interventions show, quote, ignorance and disregard for the many achievements Bahrain has made and is proud of in terms of human rights. But the UK seems unfazed by this. The GCSS is notorious for defending Bahrain's human rights record, and its chairman, Omar Al-Hassan, stands accused of being in the pocket of the Bahraini embassy in the UK. According to Liberal Democrat Pierre Lord Scriven, the GCSS's claims are nothing more than a continuation of the amateurish and slapdash approach by the Bahraini authorities to try and deny their appalling human rights record and undermine or try to silence those of us who speak up. Nonetheless, the UK and Bahrain are strategic allies, and the UK is reluctant to turn words into actions when it comes to defending Bahrain's prisoners of conscience. This is just another example of the hypocrisy and double standards exercised by Western governments that benefit from maintaining the status quo. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The foreign ministries of France, Germany, Italy and Spain urge Israel to stop the construction of new settlements in occupied East Al-Quds. The European ministers say the plan to build hundreds of new settler units in Al-Quds is in violation of international law. They are also worried about the evictions and demolitions of Palestinian families in the flashpoint neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. The ministers say such measures are illegal under international law, adding that evictions and demolitions pose the risk of fueling tensions. The UN Security Council has in several resolutions condemned Israel's settlement expansion in the occupied Palestinian territories. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Limelight. The U.S. last act in Kabul was the drone slaughtering of 7 children and 3 adult civilians with a Hellfire missile. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written jointly by Rebecca Gordon and Tom Engelhardt, writers. This article is published under the heading, A World of Killer Robots? Stay tuned for more. Yes, it's true. After 20 years of war, actually more like 30 years if you count American involvement in the Soviet version of that conflict in 1980s, the United States has finally waved goodbye to Afghanistan, at least for now. Its last act in Kabul was the drone slaughtering of 7 children and 3 adult civilians with a Hellfire missile. And that, as Asmat Khan recently showed in a striking report in the New York Times magazine, was pretty much par for a course in this country's global so-called war on terror, that for countless civilians has distinctly been a war of terror of the most horrific sort. In those same years, this country, the United States, led the way in the use of Hellfire missile-armed drones globally, while U.S. president, any president you care to name, became an assassin-in-chief, something Donald Trump showed all too clearly when he used a drone to assassinate Iranian top commander at Baghdad International Airport in January 2020. And though Joe Biden has launched significantly fewer drone strikes so far than his predecessors, he's still been ordering them too. Worse yet, it's sadly clear that however scientific like those drones once seemed, they are still piloted by actual human beings, even if from far, far away. As such, they represent a relatively early stage in the process of fully automating weapon systems on land, on sea, and in the air, and the decision-making that goes with them. And here's a scenario to consider. A military force has purchased 1 million cheap, disposable flying drones, each the size of a deck of cards, each capable of carrying 3 grams of explosives, enough to kill a single person or, in a shaped charge, pierce a steel wall. They have been programmed to seek out and engage, kill certain human beings, based on specific signature characteristics, like carrying a weapon, say, or having a particular skin color. They fit in a single shipping container and can be deployed remotely. Once launched, they will fly and kill autonomously without any further human action. Science fiction? Not really. It could happen tomorrow. The technology already exists. In fact, lethal autonomous weapon systems, or LAWs, have a long history. Washington faced quite a few strategic problems in prosecuting its war in Indochina, including the general corruption and unpopularity of the South Vietnamese regime it was propping up. Its biggest military challenge, however, was probably North Vietnam's continual infiltration of personnel and supplies on what was called the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which ran from north to south along the Cambodian and Laotian borders. The trail was, in fact, a network of easily repaired dirt roads and footpaths, streams and rivers lying under a thick jungle canopy that made it almost impossible to detect movement from the air. The U.S. response, developed by Jason in 1966 and deployed the following year, was an attempt to interdirect that infiltration by creating an automated battlefield composed of four parts. Analog to a human body's eyes, nerves, brain, and limbs. The eyes were a broad variety of sensors, acoustic, seismic, even chemical for sensing human urine, most dropped by air into the jungle. The nerve equivalents transmitted signals to the brain. However, since the sensors had a maximum transmission range of only about 20 miles, the U.S. military had to constantly fly aircraft above the foliage to catch any signal that might be tripped by passing North Vietnamese troops or transports. The planes would then relay the news to the brain, originally intended to be remote controlled. Those aircraft performed so poorly that human pilots were usually necessary. And that brain, a magnificent military installation secretly built in Thailand's Nakhon Phanom, housed two state-of-the-art IBM mainframe computers. A small army of programs wrote and rewrote the code to keep them ticking as they attempt to make sense of the stream of data transmitted by those planes. The target coordinates they came up with war, then transmitted to attack aircraft, which were the limb equivalents. The group running that automated battlefields were designated Task Force Alpha, and the whole project went under the code name Igloo White. As it turned out, Igloo White was largely an expensive failure, costing about $1 billion a year for 5 years, almost $40 billion total in today's dollars. The time lag between a sensor tripping and munitions dropping made the system ineffective. As a result, at times, Task Force Alpha simply carpet-bombed areas where a single sensor might have gone off. The North Vietnamese quickly realized how those sensors worked and developed methods of following them from playing truck ignition recordings to planting buckets of urine. Given the history of semi-automated weapon systems like drones and smart bombs, in the intervening years, you probably won't be surprised to learn that this first automated battlefield couldn't discriminate between soldiers and civilians. In this, they merely continued a trend that's existed since at least the 18th century, in which wars routinely kill more civilians than combatants. None of these shortcomings kept Defense Department officials of the United States from regarding the automated battlefield with awe. Andrew Cockburn described this worshipful posture in his book Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, quoting Leonard Sullivan, a high-ranking Pentagon official who visited Vietnam in 1968. Quote, just as it is almost impossible to be an agnostic in the Cathedral of Notre Dame, so it is difficult to keep from being swept up in the beauty and majesty of the Task Force Alpha Tembo. Unquote. Who or what, you well might wonder, was to be worshipped in such a temple? Most aspects of that Vietnam-era automated battlefield actually required human intervention. Human beings were planting the sensors, programming the computers, piloting the airplanes, and releasing the bombs. In what sense, then, was that battlefield automated? As a harbinger of what was to come, the system had eliminated human intervention at a single crucial point in the process, the decision to kill. On that automated battlefield, the computers decided where and when to drop the bombs. In 1969, Army Chief of Staff William Westmoreland expressed his enthusiasm for this removal of the messy human element from war making. Addressing a luncheon for the Association of the U.S. Army, a lobbying group, he declared, "On the battlefield of the future, enemy forces will be located, tracked, and targeted almost instantaneously through the use of data links, computer-assisted intelligence evaluation, and automated fire control. With first-round kill probabilities approaching certainty, and with surveillance devices that can continually track the enemy, the need for large forces to fix the opposition will be less important." What Westmoreland meant by fix the opposition was kill the enemy. Another military euphemism in the 21st century is engage. In either case, the meaning is the same. The role of lethal autonomous weapon systems is to automatically find and kill human beings without human intervention.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
What is it you would be trying to do on climate change? What is it you would be trying to prevent if you were leading the United States at the conference?
Well, first of all, I think one of the dumbest statements I've ever heard in politics, in the history of politics as I know it, was Obama's statement that our number one problem is global warming, okay? When we have large groups of people that want to blow up every one of our cities, that want to destroy our country, that want to kill our people, and he's worried about global warming. I think it's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.
Having two cars, three cars in your family and a television set in every room and living that sort of life that people live in developed countries and even in emerging economies now has a cost to it. The cost is climate change.
And the time is running out. Time is running out. We've got 10, as the scientists say, we have 10 years to reduce our emissions by 90%. You know, we've got to keep 80% of the fossil fuels in the ground. That's a massive shift in our ways of life.
It is going to affect the way we do everything. It is going to affect the way we transport ourselves. It's going to affect what we eat, when we eat. It's going to affect how we heat, cool our homes. It's going to affect how we build our homes. It's going to affect mostly, certainly how we produce our food. It's going to affect practically every human endeavor.
If we fail in Paris, then the whole world is looking at a globally catastrophic situation, which will not spare anybody. It will hit the rich countries. New York will be affected, Berlin will be affected, London will be affected. It will affect everybody.
The average temperature on Earth has already risen by 1 degree Celsius. If we exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming, most ecosystems will collapse. To prevent this, the United Nations has been trying to reach a global climate agreement since 1995. My film team and I are going to Paris to meet the people who are deciding about our future.
Guardians of the Earth, Part 3.
Night has fallen, and the COP venue is calm for the moment. Skepticism continues to grow, and the numbers make clear why. The current text still has 1,585 square brackets and issues to be resolved. There are 9 days left.
The initial assessment showed that Haiyan left a wake of massive destruction that is unprecedented, unthinkable. Mr. President, I speak for my delegation, but I speak for the countless people who will no longer be able to speak for themselves. Now, Mr. President, if you will allow me, Super Typhoon Haiyan made landfall in my own family's hometown, and the devastation.
After Marshall, without me knowing the full reason behind it, I was taken out of the Philippine delegation. So it's not as if I walked away from the process. I was taken out. And if I was taken out because I have been vocal about rich nations having to take responsibility and about the fossil fuel industry being the biggest problem that stands in the way, that should give me a lot of pride to be taken out. Because climate change is a battle that will not be won or lost in the conference halls here.
I've always said the climate change negotiations stopped being about climate change a long time ago. It's about economy, it's about interests, it's about who pays for your election campaign. Fortunately, what we're seeing now is the business sector is ahead of the politicians. They're changing. They're turning around.
We pay a visit to COP Solutions, an exhibition where businesses tell us how they intend to take part in solving the climate crisis. Among them are the world's biggest banks and energy-producing corporations, which are also sponsoring COP.
This place is a corporate greenwashing exercise, and they're not allowing us to say so. These organizations have paid up to 250,000 euros to have not just a stand in here, but political influence. Engie and these companies, you're not part of the solution. And it seems the only way that you can make your voice heard when you haven't got 250,000 euros is to do something like this. Take direct action, make a noise, and actually make our voices heard. Money will not silence the people, and we will be heard. Unfortunately, money can buy you quite a lot of security. So we're going to be taken out, but it does not end here. We're going to continue. We're going to be in the streets. We're going to be on the front lines. We're going to take down Engie and the others whilst they are in our communities, and we're going to make sure that actually our climate future is in the hands of people and not big business.
From an insider, we receive information on how successful lobbying works. We learn, for example, that negotiators have given in to the aviation industry's demands and removed text that would have limited pollution from airplanes.
We are very pleased to see that within the last few days there's been a tremendous amount of momentum and support from civil society, from the world, and indeed from a number of countries, including developed and developing countries. And we hope that by the next few days we will complete an agreement that recognizes 1.5 degrees, but not only that, the means to achieve that. Do you have a microphone over there?
What kind of response are you seeing, particularly from oil-producing countries, to this goal of 1.5 degrees?
Thank you very much, Suzanne. I'm going to invite Wael Maidan to answer the question.
Yes, it's unfortunate that the Arab group is the mainly only group that is opposing 1.5, and this is surprising because part of the Arab region is supporting 1.5. Now, how much we'd be able to have a complete shift, and including Saudi Arabia accepting 1.5, it's going to be part of the trade-offs that could possibly happen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to make an announcement that we are not here to accept the minimalist Paris Agreement. So every minister standing on this stage has joined the Ambition Coalition, and we will fight to protect the ambition in the agreement.
I have a question about the EU, who is part of this coalition but not present now. Can you explain why?
President of the EU is here.
Yes, sir. Yes, hello. It's for us normal to be on the Ambition Coalition because we need a long-term target. We need tools that can operationalize this target, so the EU is present from the beginning.
Thank you, Madam President. Thank you very, very much. We will need to go now. Thank you very much.
What we are calling the High Ambition Coalition. This is a group of countries that is fully committed to ensuring that the agreement is a truly ambitious one. You know, this is not a situation where we have to hope and pray that some smart person is going to come along and find the solution. No, we already have the solution. The solution to climate change is energy policy. Sure, we're going to continue to pump gas and oil for years. We know that. We're not going to leave here knowing that everything we do is going to hit the 2-degree mark. But what we're doing is sending the marketplace an extraordinary signal that those 186 countries are really committed. And that helps the private sector to move capital into that, knowing there's a future that is committed to this sustainable path.
Targets that they have brought to this summit lead us to an extremely dangerous world. They don't lead us to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius. For setting a target of warming that may allow the low-lying Pacific Islands to survive, and I say may, our governments are demanding that those countries explicitly give up their right to seek loss and damages for climate change. It says it in the text right now.
The negotiators haven't slept for the past 2 days, with the talks continuing behind closed doors 24/7.
I'm hoping we preserve the high ambition elements, which are still in the text, in everything. But as they wheel and deal and compromise, there's a tendency to give up things. And right now, in the next few hours, I predict there'll be moves to jettison as much of it as possible, because that's how you get compromise. You get compromise by agreeing to the lowest common denominator, not by going to the upper end of the ambition. Then the bits that are easiest to sacrifice are the bits that the vulnerable and poorest countries hold dearest, but they're the ones who have least leverage in holding on to stuff. I'm very afraid that we will start losing all the ambitious language that's in the text now.
At 4 o'clock in the morning, the COP president calls an emergency meeting to resolve the conflict about the final wording of the agreement. The majority of countries demand 1.5 in the text, but a single veto can block this demand. This meeting is closed to the public, but we've managed to sneak inside.
Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, short speeches, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. We are of the view that it should read as follows. Hold the increase in the global average temperature to below 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. Full stop. And again, the word would like to see may in that article. With that, Mr. President, I should thank you.
Well, Mr. President, we appreciate your leadership enormously. This agreement, I have to tell you, my friends, this is a monument to differentiation. This is the single most differentiated agreement I've ever seen in my life because of the 186 voluntary, nationally determined plans. And I hope we'll look very carefully and not get hung up over word for word that don't really have an impact. I mean, I'll give you an example. All parties should strive to formulate and communicate long-term low greenhouse gas emission development strategies. Now, it's been recommended that that be deleted. I find it really hard to understand how the word strive threatens anybody. We can't afford, in the hours we have left and in the time we have, and given the spirit with which we've all come here, to nitpick every single word of this agreement. I don't believe that's where we are. Thank you, Mr. President.
My schedule is this one. Today, Friday, I will try to pull the pieces together, and I will consult the different groups during the day, not right now, but during the day, and I will be in a position to present a text, which will be the final text, tomorrow. Thank you very much.
In a desperate decision, the United Nations extends the negotiations by one day. Everybody's exhausted, and time's running out to reach the necessary agreement. The COP president makes a last-ditch attempt to bring the opposed sides together in secret talks.
I'm off.
Okay. Good.
Good. Well done. Well done. Yeah, you should be proud.
Yes.
You should be proud.
I thought
it was a good
package.
Yeah.
It is good.
It is a good package.
What do you want more than that?
Exactly. Exactly.
And no, this is the core thing.
It's very good.
Yes.
It's a good agreement for us.
Yes, I think it's a good agreement.
Okay.
Did out for the LDCs and developing countries.
I did what I could. You did it yourself.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to help.
Yes, yes.
Today we had a historic agreement, 1.5 degree long-term goal, despite the fact that all the rich countries and all the big developing countries did not want it when they had come to Paris. We made them change their mind.
For the first time in history, 195 nations have settled on a global agreement. Its stated objective? To limit the increase in the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius and pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The Paris Agreement shall remain in effect for the coming decades. Its success depends on the national action plans of each and every country. But the new administration in the United States is strongly opposed to the UN's multilateral approach.
This agreement gives foreign bureaucrats control over how much our energy and how much we use right here in America. So foreign bureaucrats are going to be controlling what we're using and what we're doing on our land in our country. No way. We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
In order to reach the 1.5 degree target, worldwide emissions have to be drastically reduced by 2020. The United States of America is responsible for almost one-third of these emissions.
The Limelight. Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party in the United States, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Lisa Lehrer and Astrid Herndon. The piece is titled "Menace Enters the Republican Mainstream." Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. At a conservative rally in western Idaho last month, a young man stepped up to a microphone to ask when he could start killing Democrats. "When do we get to use the guns?" he said, as the audience applauded. "How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people?" The local state representative, a Republican, later called it a fair question. In Ohio, the leading candidate in the Republican primary for Senate blasted out a video urging Republicans to resist the tyranny of a federal government that pushed them to wear face masks and take FDA-authorized vaccines. "When the Gestapo show up at your front door," the candidate, Josh Mandel, a grandson of a Holocaust survivor, said in the video in September, "you know what to do." And in Congress, violent threats against lawmakers are on track to double this year. Republicans who break party ranks and defy former President Donald J. Trump have come to expect insults, invective, and even death threats, often stoked by their own colleagues and conservative activists who have denounced them as traitors. From congressional offices to community meeting rooms, threats of violence are becoming commonplace among a significant segment of the Republican Party. 10 months after rioters attacked the United States Capitol on 6th of January, and after 4 years of a president who often spoke in violent terms about his adversaries, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force, as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodge them from power. In Washington, where decorum and civility are still given lip service, violent or threatening language still remains uncommon, if not unheard of, among lawmakers who spend a great deal of time in the same building. But among the most fervent conservatives who play an outsized role in primary contests and provide the Republican Party with its activist energy, the belief that the country is at a crossroads that could require armed confrontation is no longer limited to the fringe. Political violence has been part of the American story since the founding of the country, often entwined with racial politics and erupting in periods of great change. More than 70 brawls, duels, and other violent incidents embroiled members of Congress from 1830 to 1860 alone, and elements of the left have contributed to the confrontational tenor of the country's current politics, though Democratic leaders routinely condemn violence and violent imagery. But historians and those who study democracy say what has changed has been the embrace of violent speech by a sizable proportion of one party, including some of its loudest voices inside government and most influential voices outside of government. In effect, they warn the Republican Party is mainstreaming menace as a political tool. Omar Russell, a political scientist at Pomona College who studies protests and race, drew a contrast between the current climate and earlier periods of turbulence and strife, like the 1960s or the run-up to the Civil War. What's different about almost all those other events is that now there's a partisan divide around the legitimacy of our political system, he said. The elite endorsement of political violence from factions of the Republican Party is distinct for me from what we saw in the 1960s. Then you didn't have, from a president on down, politicians calling citizens to engage in violent resistance. From his earliest campaigning to the final moments of his presidency, Donald Trump's political image has incorporated the possibility of violence. Trump encouraged attendees at his rallies to knock the hell out of protesters, praised the lawmaker who body slammed a reporter, and in a recent interview defended rioters who clamored to hang Mike Pence. Yet even with the former president largely out of the public eye, and after a deadly attack on the Capitol where rioters tried to overturn the presidential election, the Republican acceptance of violence has only spread.